We are very, very lucky to have a diversity of wildlife in the state, a big diversity. And with every change in the weather and the season, I think there are some fascinating differences in what happens with our wildlife around the state. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's something to watch for and marvel in, I think, every season, isn't there? And watching our wildlife, I think it's really fascinating, and so do my guests. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. David, always great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me back.
And with us as well, Jamie Neck. Jamie is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And Jamie, great to see you as well.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks for having us.
We have lots that we can talk about. You may have a question for our guests as you listen in here. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. A question or maybe an experience to share. Love to hear from you. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We got a great wildlife photo. We'd love to see that as well. You know, we've talked about urban wildlife with you two before, especially about the foxes that are living on the UW-Madison campus. And we have an update on, you have an update, I should say, on the efforts to learn more about them and coyotes as well. David.
Yeah, so we had a pilot project going on last winter, spring of 2014, to kind of trap and radio collar a couple of coyotes, and we were able to trap and radio collar a red fox here on campus and just kind of follow them around and start to get some baseline data on them. And it became such an interesting project, and there was so much fascination amongst the public, especially for the red foxes, that I was able to scramble some grants together, and I've got a graduate student, Marcus Mueller, who just started a couple weeks ago, and so we've been able to expand this into a graduate project, and we are out actively trying to trap coyotes and red fox right now, and moderate success, not as much success as we'd like currently, but hopefully this cold weather and snow will help us a little bit. And so ultimately, if everything goes well, we'd like to catch 30 fox if we can and 30 coyote, not only here on the UW-Madison campus, but we're expanding the project out into the greater Madison area. Mm-hmm. And we've got a couple of goals for the project. One is, so Marcus's thesis or his research will be looking at how these animals share resources in this urbanized area. And mm-hmm. traditionally, coyotes are predators of red fox. And if they can catch them, they'll usually kill them. And where you have a lot of coyotes, you typically don't have a lot of red fox. And this is especially true out in the country areas. But for some reason here in the cities, and this is not just true for Madison, but other cities, that fox and coyote are able to share the same space. And we want to figure out how they're able to do that. And mm-hmm. so that's one of the project goals. We're also collecting some health data on these animals because we want to see what diseases they're currently carrying and what diseases they've been exposed to, because there's some implications not only for unvaccinated domestic dogs that these animals might encounter, but domestic dogs that are unvaccinated can also spread disease to these wild canids or the coyote and fox.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are getting, Jamie as well, we're getting a lot more people responding to us by email and things like that, that they're seeing more red fox and coyote, and they're also having more encounters with them. So we're getting, you know, pretty commonly we're getting stories about people walking down the sidewalk with their dog and they're being trailed by a coyote or a red fox maybe 30 feet behind. And so we want to take this opportunity to kind of figure out more about where these animals are living, their activity patterns, and we're trying to be
how they interact with people.
Absolutely. And we're trying to be proactive so that we can start heading off any conflicts that might occur. And also, you know, kind of educate people about what to do so you don't exaggerate conflicts, and also the, when you encounter one of these animals, what to do to keep yourself and your pets safe.
It's so interesting. I mean, last night here it's snowing, and I live on the east side of Madison, and of course, get home and almost home, and there's four female turkeys in the street, and somebody's out there kind of
shooing them,
get them across the road so they don't get run over. And there's four males in the area. They were all together, and now, of course, they've split up just before the breeding season. And I saw the four males the other day, or the toms, all fanned out and big blue heads and gobbling up a storm.
Yeah, there's a lot of urban wildlife out there for sure.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, lots of opportunity to see these animals. And especially right now is a great time, just when you're driving, to be on the lookout in the fields and on fence rows to be looking for fox and coyote because it's their breeding season. So between January, February, both coyote and fox are breeding, and they'll have litters in March and April. So
yeah.
They're a lot more active as they're looking for mates.
We got a call from Mary who said that she recently saw a coyote in Monona, right near Monona Drive. Of course, Monona and Madison all kind of run together almost. She wonders what the issues are of coyotes being present in urban areas. Worry about it?
There are quite a few coyotes, we think, in the Madison area, and there are quite a few red fox in the Madison area. And there was just a study that came out, Stan Garrett at Ohio State University, or I should say the Ohio State University, has been a pioneer in this field, and he's been radio collaring and trapping coyotes down in the Chicago area since 2000. And so he thinks there's probably at least 2,000 coyotes in Chicago. And we don't have that many here, obviously, but we've got quite a few here. And with the population of, Madison, it's 300 and some thousand in the city. And then you think about how many people are in the suburbs and things like that. So the point is, considering how many of these coyotes we have and how many people we have, we really have very, very few negative interactions or encounters. And that's a good thing. But a couple of things just to make sure that we're not causing problems or creating problems or conflicts with these animals is, certainly don't feed them. Do not ever directly offer food to any wildlife. You shouldn't, with the exception of backyard bird feeding. If you do feed your dogs outside or your pets outside, make sure that coyotes and fox don't have access to that pet food. If you have coyotes in your yard or fox in your yard and you don't want them there and you have bird feeders, take the bird feeders down, because even though these fox and coyote don't eat the seed, they certainly eat the small mammals that are being attracted to the seed dropping to the ground. If you are out and your dog is off leash, get your dog on leash. That will help. And if you've got coyote or fox that are coming through your yard, fox isn't as big of an issue as coyotes because coyotes are a bigger animal. But if you have them coming through your yard, you also may just want to be vigilant if you let your dog outside. And if you have a fenced area, keep the dog in a fenced area and things like that.
Yeah.
And lastly, I'll just say if you do see a coyote or a fox around you, these animals do get habituated or used to living around us. And the more habituated they are, the more bold they get. So when you see these animals, if you can, yell at them, wave your arms, maybe throw something. You don't want to throw something to hurt them, but throw something at them. And we want to keep these animals fearful of us, and that will create a peaceful coexistence between us and them.
Yesterday, at least in parts of Wisconsin, especially southern Wisconsin, it snowed like crazy, and somebody was saying, oh, I wonder how, back to the turkeys for a second, how are these turkeys going to live, get through the... through the winter, and a lot of people, I think, wonder about that. And there's a great article in the most recent issue of the Wisconsin Natural Resources magazine. It's called "Toughing It Out When the Temperatures Drop." Maybe we could talk about some of those techniques, Jamie.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to put a plug in for that magazine.
It's a great magazine.
Yeah, anyway. It's for a yearly subscription. It is $8.97, six issues. It's phenomenal, and there's such a breadth of topics covered that there's something for everybody. And this issue was nothing short of that. There were quite a few articles that had particular interest to myself. But, in talking about how animals survive, they have evolved with adaptations to help them survive the cold temperatures, the snow, and so on. So we can talk about them maybe as taxonomic groups. So when we talk about birds, some of the birds, their strategy is to migrate. Mm-hmm. Others that do stay here, they have, if you think about a little chickadee, they might roost or hold up together in groups in conifer trees. Or they'll also fluff their feathers, which provides more air in the pockets of the feathers to provide insulation. So that helps them in that manner. They also, when we think about their feet, or you see a Canada goose standing on ice and...
On 1 foot?
Yeah, on 1 foot, but we're thinking, man, their feet must be really cold, but they have the ability to shunt off the blood to their extremities, so there isn't any blood flow and there isn't damage being done.
Insects, are an interesting one to me because you mentioned migrating, and I guess most insects other than monarchs,
there's
a few that migrate, but most of them hang around right here.
Yep. And you'll...
Yeah, they get underneath the substrate or underneath loose bark and just kind of hold away and are able to avoid the deep freezes.
Yeah, and I know we get a lot of the ladybugs, you know, popping out of our places in our house you never expect them to be when the weather starts getting warm. So they find these microclimates and are able to survive the winter just fine.
Yep.
But, you know, one thing I also add about the birds, and this is true for other animals that stay up in northern climates, if they're not hibernating and they're out and active during the winter, you know, a lot of these animals have also a dark coat or a dark plumage. And as you know, that helps absorb solar radiation. So on nice, warm, sunny days, or I shouldn't say nice, warm, sunny days, but on sunny days, even though it might be bitterly cold, if they can stay out of the wind, they're absorbing quite a bit of solar radiation. That also helps keep them warm. And you know, certainly they eat a ton of food as well, and that keeps their metabolism running pretty high.
In terms of mammals, of course, bears hibernate, but
they're not a true hibernator, though. I mean, they're in a category of hibernation, but they're not a true hibernator in that they can have bouts of, you know, where they arouse and are active. But for the most part, their strategy is, of course, to pack on a lot of fat in the fall, heavy on acorns and high protein fatty foods, and then sleep away the winter. And sows will have their young while they're in the den and then emerge come March, April again, depending on the weather. So some of our true hibernators would be some of the ground squirrels, like the chipmunks and the...
groundhog.
The 13-line ground squirrel.
Groundhogs, bats.
Yep.
They're
bats
done for the winter.
Yep.
They're
yep.
down. Yep. Their food source is just not available to them during that time of year.
Groundhogs, do they...
They're true
hibernators.
They dig down in the ground, obviously, and...
Yep, get below the frost line and...
just burrow in there, and it's nice and warm, and, you know, they've got a pretty thick coat on them, and as Jamie said, they gorge, you know, prior to hibernation and put a nice thick layer of fat on that they kind of live off of. And, you know, one thing that's kind of interesting about groundhogs, so they're a rodent species. And rodents, one of the reasons they're constantly gnawing is because those front teeth are always growing. And if they don't gnaw, they gnaw to keep the teeth filed down. Well, groundhogs, when they hibernate, their teeth stop growing during the hibernation period, which makes sense because otherwise, you know, for 6 months when they're not active, they pop up and all of a sudden they have these tusks kind of hanging out of their face. So it is kind of interesting how these animals, there's some of the physiological adaptations to survive the winter and things like that. It's pretty fascinating.
And I can tell you, those groundhogs, they get a little testy when they're awakened up, as the mayor of Sun Prairie found out.
That's right.
It's a pretty interesting story, yes.
Yeah. If you haven't heard that, as you're listening, if you haven't heard that one, the mayor of Sun Prairie has Jimmy the groundhog. And the handler held Jimmy the groundhog up next to the mayor's ear and then bit the mayor's ear.
That even made the Daily Show with Jon Stewart last night. So.
Oh, it did? I didn't see that. Oh, yeah. Well, the mayor said, Jimmy the groundhog, he has my ear.
Yeah, that's right.
Good recovery.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, listen here. I have lots of questions, but you might have one too, so give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Nack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. And Bill in Ashland up next. Bill, hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Hey, this is Bill calling. I got a couple of things that I got it's a bird feeder, but it's a menagerie in my backyard where I get all kinds of birds in there, right?
Yep.
So I kind of enhanced it a little bit. In the springtime, for instance, I'll put out nesting material, and it's kind of fun to watch them pick at that stuff, you know. The interesting thing is last year I put out a couple of brushfuls of my old gray hair, you know, that I got plenty of. You know, put them out there in the spot there. You know, about the time I put the hummingbird feeders out, and they had hummingbirds coming in like every day, you know. But then we had a big windstorm come through, and they went out in the yard there. Doggone it, here was a hummingbird nest, but it was made out of my hair.
That's great.
That was so cool. I still got that thing, too. Yeah. Another thing I did this winter is I put, you know, these little bubbler things that you see, like, in waiting areas and hospitals, you know, that water flow to them. Yeah, I got one of those out there in the picnic table. It holds about a quart and a half of water. You know, and you got to kind of keep an eye on it when it gets 20 or so, you know, but the water circulating in there keeps it going, and man, it's amazing how many birds come in to take a drink off that thing.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point, Bill. Thanks for calling. And
yeah,
you guys...
I mean, birds get water from a bunch of different sources in the winter. It could be from what they're eating, but also some birds, like a chickadee, may take on some snow, but it's a very little return when they melt that snow. So if you do add a heated bird bath or a water fountain option, mm-hmm. like Bill was talking about, you can really affect the number of birds coming and visiting your backyard. So it is really important.
And the other thing I would add, Bill, it's a great story about the hare. But the other enhancement I'd add, as the birds start beginning to nest, as they're actively also nesting, another great enhancement is to put out something high in calcium. So, for example, eggshells or oyster shell grit that's broken into small bits, because those animals, calcium is kind of a limiting factor in their diet, and they need that calcium to deposit the eggshells as they're laying the eggs. And so if you have that calcium-enriched enhancement, you also will get some more birds that maybe your neighbors won't be getting if they don't have that kind of an enhancement out.
And you can buy that commercially, but you can also make your own by just hanging on to eggshells and collecting them. But then the key here is that you're going to need to crush
them up.
Put them in the oven there's probably a recipe online if you Google it for how long and what temperature, but you want to avoid any disease issues or salmonella.
Yep.
And Bill, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you have a sighting, or maybe you've got a question about our wildlife. I hope you'll join us. You can also email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Sandy in Madison has a question for us next. Sandy, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Yes, hello, thank you, and thank you for taking my phone call. I live on the west side of Madison, and we have a pair of foxes in our neighborhood. We love watching them, and I'm wondering what process is going to be used if the fox are captured, how long they're going to stay in the study, and what happens while they're there, and then when do they get released?
Mm-hmm. Sandy, that's a great question. Thank you for asking. So first off, I'll mention everything we are doing is approved by the College of Ag Life Science here on UW-Madison campus through an animal care use protocol. So we've got an approval for that. We're also working under Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources research permit. And so what we'll do is we have got cable restraints out, and once we catch the animal, we check those cable restraints. Every time we have them open, we check them at least twice a day. Legally, we're required to check them once a day, right? So we check them twice a day. And so the animal typically is not in that restraint probably more than 12 hours at the most. And once we catch them, we anesthetize the animal with some drugs, and then we draw some blood out of the a vein in the leg. We weigh them. We take a swab of their nasal area and their anus to see what diseases they might be exposed to or currently carrying. And then we put a radio collar on the animal, and that radio collar will track that animal for the life of the animal or the life of the radio collar, whichever expires first. And the radio collar, the battery life is up to 3 years, 2 to 3 years for sure. If from our pilot study last year, about 2/3 of our sample size got killed by cars within the first 6 months. So I expect that the radios are probably going to outlast the animal. But so we'll see what happens with that. But one thing we are trying to do, because there is so much interest, again, especially with the foxes amongst the public, that we are inviting the public to come and check traps with us. And also, once we start getting these animals on radio collars and on the air, that the public's welcome to come and radio track with us as well. And we see this as a great outreach opportunity to kind of educate people about why these animals are moving into the city. Again, just understanding a little bit more about the ecology of the animal, what to do if you see the animal, and things like that. So if you go to our Facebook page that we've started for this project, UW Urban Canid Project, You can see what we're doing. We're updating the face page, Facebook page multiple times a week. And if you want to email us, and maybe we can put this up on your website,
Yeah, Larry. We've got it. If we don't have it up, Judith will have it up.
We'll put up an email address where if you want to contact us and come out and join us in this effort, we'd love the public to come and help us. And we'll put that email up, and then you can just email us, and we'll schedule a time for you to join us.
Yeah, we'll get that up today for sure. Yes. Judith's saying, yeah, we'll
okay.
get that up.
Thank you very much, Sandy, for the question.
Okay, thank you for the information. And it's important to keep those animals healthy and safe.
Yep.
Yeah, that's for sure. Sandy, you might want to join in. It sounds like a fun thing to do, to be honest.
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you. John in Heartland, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question that relates to the expanding turkey population, certainly the explosion of the turkey population. I live in southeastern Wisconsin, but I travel quite a bit throughout the state, noticing the turkeys flourishing in every seeming habitat there is. And one thing that I've noticed as a side note to that is I have noticed an expanding coyote population that seems to me on the border of potentially being, you know, somewhat out of control in some situations, as well as the impact that may have on the whitetail population just from a forage, ground forage standpoint. And I'm wondering if there's been any studies done on that or if there's any comments you may have on that topic.
Well, certainly the turkeys have flourished since their reintroduction and have now populated more counties than I think any of the original folks involved with that reintroduction ever thought. So as far as I know, there are now turkeys in every county of Wisconsin, and the thought was originally that cold temperatures, the winters would limit their distribution from going further north, and that's just not been the case. So from agricultural crops and just, you know, good food sources, roosting cover, hardwood stands, they've been able to flourish throughout the state. So that's part of it. As far as the comments on the coyotes, we get questions about species being more abundant than in years past, coming in from local reports, and you know, they kind of ebb and flow within local areas. So across the state, we'd probably be referring to some of the trapping or the fur bearer harvest records to get an idea of coyote populations. I've not heard that we've got a burgeoning coyote population or a declining coyote population. So I think just locally you may have seen an uptick maybe in how many times you've seen coyotes lately and so on. So certainly a coyote could take a turkey. I've seen or heard of turkey hunters have them attack their turkey decoys as they're hunting in the spring. So certainly that's a potential prey item. But given the population sizes of both of those animals, I don't know that coyotes are going to have a large impact on turkeys. And as far as in relation to deer, kind of tying this all together, I think some of what's playing out is a change of the habitat and the landscape in general. So in general, Wisconsin's forests are, I mean, they're always maturing every day. They get older, but we have had less cutting and harvesting as we have in the past, particularly in the southwestern part of the state where we used to have abundant grouse. And in, even in the north, on across our public and federal lands, there's less, you know, that forest is aging. So we're seeing changes in terms of deer populations. And
the
it just trickles
probably
down.
Have nothing to do with it, I don't think.
No, there's probably, yeah, not changes in...
The turkeys aren't eating up the food that the deer
No,
would
for
have.
Sure. They're eating different food. Deer are going to be browsers, clipping the grass and woody vegetation, and turkeys are going to be, especially in the spring and summer, they're foraging on insects with their poults for the high protein, and then they're feeding on more mast crops and things like that.
But one interaction between the deer and turkeys, I think, is going on, though, is, you know, where you have overabundant deer populations, you do get heavy browse. And so
makes it easier to move.
It makes it easier to move. And turkeys, they like open understory areas so they can see the predators coming from a long way. And so where you've had overabundant deer populations and they've actually devegetated the understory of forests, that is really good turkey habitat. And I think it's allowed the turkey populations to grow up because they've improved the habitat for the turkeys. So there's some interaction there. I haven't seen that in
Yeah,
in
I guess,
the
John, I mean, to answer your question, to point to any current research, I haven't seen it. Maybe somebody listening is aware of some, at least from the Midwest. Most of it is anecdotal, talking to biologists and so on.
Okay. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. a good friend of mine, Bob Cooney, was hunting in the fall. I maybe told you the story before. Anyway, he's up on a ridge, and there were some turkeys at the down at sort of the bottom of the area, and then there were some young deer, and the one of the young deer would kind of run over to the turkey and then run back, and then the turkey would run over to the deer and run back, and they were playing.
And yeah, so
the only way you could describe it, they were playing.
Yeah, it's not uncommon to see the two species feeding together in the same field within close proximity. So
that's just like in the movie Bambi.
Yeah.
Casey in Port Wing, it is your turn. Hi, Casey.
How are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
First off, I would like to thank your guests for the excellent job they do, but I would expect none less from being a tax-paid job specification for the state of Wisconsin. You guys are doing a great job, and the taxpayers' dollars are not being wasted in employing you. In Bayfield County, which is on the shore of Lake Superior, I would ask you, have you been up there lately, by the way, the last 6 months? Bayfield County, Douglas County.
I have not.
I was there in November.
Okay. All right, well, that's a good part of the state to go visit if you want to see real wildlife, not city wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, in my property there, it is very obvious that the bobcat population has really blossomed, if not exploded. Of course, they're competing with cougars and timber wolves and the coyotes and foxes that live up there, too. But it is when a bobcat will come out at 10 o'clock in the morning and snag a gray squirrel out of a bird feeder, I would think that they're also taking deer. Another wildlife. I haven't seen a rabbit in 3 years in Bayfield County. The rabbit population is completely gone. And I'm sure the foxes and coyotes attribute to that too, and the wolves. But if you could check on how the bobcat population is really decimating the deer population in northern Wisconsin, especially in northwestern and on shore Lake Superior, I would really appreciate that. And I would take any comments you have off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Casey, for calling. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And it's not an uncommon observation when we talk about large carnivores and, wondering if that if they have an impact on the white-tailed deer population. So we could replace bobcat with bears, with coyotes, with wolf in terms of addressing this question. So there was a 3-4 year study on fawn mortality and also a large number of adult deer that were radio collared, much like David's doing with these coyote and fox. And they were followed both in the northern near Winter and near East Central and Shawano. So two study areas, they collared a large number of deer and fawns and were looking specifically at mortality. So as we build the structure of our deer population to be able to estimate population and determine what the quotas are going to be and what the hunting season structure looks like, we wanted to add some additional information to that. So I do not have the numbers or information in front of me, but if you go to the DNR website and type in deer research, you'll get to that study and some field reports from it. But there were a number of predators on the fawns, including bobcat, but I don't think any one of them was particularly higher than the next. So, bobcat.
Bear take them, wolves take them.
Bears are pretty good because you wouldn't think of them as being very fast, but as they are opportunistically moving through the forest, if they come across a fawn and that fawn is just a few days old and tries to get up, they're able to tackle that fawn. So at that young age, bears can be a predator of white-tailed deer. I imagine it's very similar with bobcat. I would be surprised to hear reports of bobcat as a single animal taking down a healthy deer. So I think most of those predations are on the young animal or the sick or the injured. And we have to keep in mind that predation is part of the system. We expect populations to have some predation. So I don't know that these are at extremely high levels that are not going to, they're certainly going to support, the deer population can support some harvest or through through predation. So
there we go.
But that research is available. So take a look at it on the DNR website.
And Judith already has put up a link to your urban fox coyote, your canid project. So it's up on our Facebook page. And so if people want to go there, and then is the email address included on the Facebook page?
It is, but we can also give that and maybe
go ahead and give it.
At break, we can put that up as well. But, yeah, thank you very much, Judith.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to Chris in West Bend. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just make a comment that my family and I have been enjoying a pair of eagles nesting in Minnesota, and the Department of Natural Resource of Minnesota has an eagle cam on a nest, and there are currently three eggs, and they've been coming back and forth, and you can see them nestling on their eggs. And last year, we were able to watch two of the three eggs come to fruition and fly from the nest, and it was just great fun. And so it appears that this pair has got three eggs, and they're roosting. And so
it's
been a lot of fun.
And where do you – it's at the Minnesota DNR?
Yeah, it's on the Minnesota DNR website, and it's an eagle cam. And, again, it was just so successful last year. I mean, the babies and how they fed them and how they tried to fly and flop around the nest a bit. And they really get pretty big before they leave the nest. So they get kind of klutzy as it nears their leaving. So it's been a lot of fun, and we're so excited to see they have three eggs. We're not sure. Last year they started out with three as well. And they had to come off out of the nest.
Chris, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You know, that reminds me, you mentioning the Eagle Cam and eagles. The DNR is running a bald eagle contest, photo contest, for a few more days. It's actually till February 8th, yep. I believe. And this is for the new endangered resources license plate.
Yes. So it's a pretty neat opportunity. And so the DNR would like people to send in photos of bald eagles that they're taking. And if your photo gets selected by a panel of review panel, then your photo will appear on the next endangered resources license plate here in Wisconsin that will feature a bald eagle on it.
That is very cool. And so, again, probably go to the DNR website for that. But if you've got, probably by this time, if you've got a really good photo of an eagle, it doesn't cost anything to enter.
That's right. Get it in.
No, it sure doesn't.
Submit
it's pretty neat. And, you know, Wisconsin has been a state that's been integral to reintroducing bald eagles in other states. And I forgot what the exact statistic is, but I think Wisconsin has given, Wisconsin's captured bald eagles in our state and relocated them to, I think, either 13 or 17 other states in the lower 48 to restart the bald eagle populations in those states. And so we've got a very, very healthy bald eagle population here. It's a great success story. There are not a lot of success stories of the Endangered Species Act where animals of actually species have been recovered and have been completely delisted, but bald eagle is one of those. And obviously it's the national bird, and it's really, really neat to see it. So, yeah, if you go to, to enter photos, if you want to do so, you can go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Facebook page and enter photos until February 8th.
There we go. Thank you, Chris. Thanks very much for calling. Mark's got something that kind of relates, so let's go there. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I wanted to talk about turkeys and actually being a true native species to Wisconsin. I have a hard time believing that they lived in the northern part, that you don't start seeing Indian hieroglyphics of turkeys until you get to southern Illinois is one reason. And the other reason is that for a ground nesting bird like a turkey that of that size to survive the winters in deep snow, you almost have to have the modern day farming fields techniques to have that large of a food source. 500 years ago, the Indians probably had cornfields, but they would be nothing like what we have today, and they would probably be guarding them or picking the corn, you know, clean. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's good question. What do you think, David?
Yeah, so turkeys are native to Wisconsin, and I think, Mark, as you were talking about, that, you know, historically they were probably restricted to more of a southern range, or, you know, the southern part of Wisconsin, and this northern range expansion of turkeys is probably relatively recent over the last few decades or so. But, you know, clearly now they're up in the northern reaches of Wisconsin, pretty firmly ensconced up there. And last year, when we had that brutally cold and just very long winter, that, you know, there was a lot of concern about animal welfare for the wildlife up there and deer and turkey and things like that. But the turkey population fared fairly well, and I believe that...
Better than the deer.
They did. And last year, I think the spring turkey harvest was up 10% over the year before that. So they came through that winter surprisingly well. But they are a native species typically restricted more to the southern part of the state, but they certainly have expanded their range northward lately.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling, Mark. Appreciate your call. We had a comment from Jacqueline, who was driving south on 3951 just north of Stevens Point near a marshy lake and saw some big nests in treetops. Some kind of rookery, she wonders? Herons? Something else?
Yeah, thanks for the post. Yeah, I mean, there are a few of the birds that will nest in rookeries, and the most common are going to be great blue herons, also cormorants, but they're going to be on larger lakes typically, and egrets are another possibility. Just thinking sheer numbers and, kind of given where you saw it and the marshy habitat, if I were to guess, I would say great blue herons. And they can have, the key point here is that you're seeing a number of nests in the area. If it's one single nest, then that sort of eliminates many of those colonial nesters. So without knowing more, yeah. I would definitely look now come breeding season and nesting season and go back to that area and set up a spotting scope and watch the area, because if it's herons or egrets, whatever the species may be, they will be flying in and out, and you'll be able to identify them. And they often return to the same rookeries from year after year. So go back in a few months and check it out.
And Judith was asking me, or reminding me to mention again, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine. That's the exact title, Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine. We have had a lot of people asking about it.
Yeah, that's great. It's also a really nice gift. It also comes with those who purchase the conservation patrons license. So you're hunting and fishing.
I get one automatically every
exactly.
year.
Yep. It comes with that purchase. So if you're on the fence about upgrading from a sportsman's license up to a patron's license, hey, you get the magazine thrown in. So and it includes your annual park passes within that package, too. So
it's Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine, and Judith also put out a link as a comment to today's show post on Facebook, so people can find it very easily that way, too. So, and it is a great magazine, and I, frankly, I don't use all aspects of that license, but I buy it as sort of a support for the DNR.
Support for conservation,
yeah,
that's
support
right.
Support for conservation, yep. Jerry in Oconomowoc, your turn. Thanks for calling, Jerry.
Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting program, and after discussing all the exotic aspects about bobcats and so on, I have a really mundane question, but I'm concerned about why, after living here about 46 years in the same location, suddenly this winter, we don't have any birds at all. I have bird feeders out suet and have a water facility for them, and we might get a junco a day or a sparrow a day. We don't see cardinals, no exotic birds, no birds. And as I walk through the neighborhood, there seems to be a lack of birds anywhere. I'm just wondering if you had any ideas.
Oconomowoc, all right.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jerry. You know, this is something that, again, I was talking to earlier. People will, I don't have any hummingbirds this year. The next caller, man, I've got more hummingbirds than I've had in the past 5 years. So some of it is just variation. But the other thing is this winter has, up until about the last couple of days, has been fairly mild, fairly warm, fairly snow-free, that those birds may be able to get their food from more natural sources and have just not had to depend on feeders for their food source. I would watch in the next couple days, fill up your feeders, given the colder temperatures and this recent snowfall, and see if that doesn't change for you. So if that's the case, then I would...
Sorry, I said I updated everything yesterday and put out some new suet, and so far looking, but it's been a rather long wait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're in a neighborhood, you know, others may be feeding birds as well. You can also, I'm not sure what type of seed you're feeding, but you get more bang for your buck with like black oil sunflower seeds rather than a commercial mix. And Judith threw out here too, I mean, it's possible that you have a aerial predator, a bird of prey, like a Cooper's or a sharp-shinned hawk in the backyard that may be keeping birds off the feeder as well. So if you're using a commercial mix, maybe switch to something more of high value and see if you can outcompete your neighbors to get those birds over in your backyard.
Yep.
But of all indications here, no health concerns or anything that we're hearing on a local basis to be worried about, so...
All right, there we go. Thank you very much for calling, Jerry. Appreciate your call. Bill and Bruce, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you. I've just noticed, it might just be me, but over the last couple of years, I drive truck all over Sawyer County, and I've noticed a big decline in the bald eagle population up here. I used to see 3 to 6 every day, and I'm lucky to see 3 or 4 a week now. I mean, I saw one this morning up by Hayward, but I don't see them like I used to. Has there been anything that you've heard of about that?
Bill, thanks for the question. I am not aware of anything that has caused a decline in the overall bald eagle population. And you know, one of the things, again, as Jamie mentioned, and I'm not sure how over what period of time you've kind of noticed that trend, but you know, as Jamie mentioned, especially this winter, it's been so mild. And obviously up north, you've gotten more snow than we have down here in the southern part of the state. But it's been relatively mild. You know, there's more open water around than there was in last year for sure, and things like that. And so these animals may be able to spread out across the landscape a little bit more than they can when we have severe winters, and they have to be concentrated around an open water or something like that. So that could be one thing. You know, there's just a lot of food resources. You think, you know, these animals will scavenge on dead deer, and if there's a cow that's died in a field, you know, they'll move to that. So they may be temporarily relocated or concentrated in an area until that food resource is exhausted. And so there's probably a number of reasons why you may not be seeing them, in addition to maybe your patterns have changed a little bit, or their patterns have changed a little bit, and things like that. But as I'm not aware of any overall decline in the bald eagle population here in Wisconsin.
Okay, thank you. Like I said, but I've noticed for like the last 2 years that it's
okay.
A decline. I used to see them every day, you know, and now
yep.
I went Winter Moose Lake, Spider Lake, and Lost Land Lake, and Hayward, and up the box, and I don't see as much as I used to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, sometimes, too, there might be a change in the landscape. Maybe a favorite nest tree or a roost tree fell down in a storm, or maybe, you know, there was some logging in the area or some development, and it disturbed the bald eagles, and they moved out of that immediate area where you are normally seeing them. But they probably moved someplace else and are doing just fine somewhere else.
Hopefully that's the case. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests, from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guests David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And lots of callers online and some good emails and Facebook comments. So we'll get right to it, and Jerry and Amherst up next. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on an earlier caller who called about a rookery that's between Stevens Point and Wausau on I-39.
Yeah.
It is a great blue heron rookery, kind of in that Lac Du Bay area in the backwaters of the Wisconsin River. Unfortunately, when there are birds on the nest, there's also foliage on the trees, and you can't see it that clearly from the road when it's active. So in winter, you can clearly see all the nests, but if you don't know it's there, you won't know where to look when it's actually occupied.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much for calling in and just helping with that identification. The other thing I would add, and I certainly understand that it would be hard to see. It makes a lot of sense. It'd be hard to see with all the foliage. Last year, Horicon National Wildlife Refuge put up a camera on a great blue heron rookery at the marsh and was live streaming it, and again raised a number of chicks off of that rookery. So I'm not sure if that effort will be going again this spring or summer, but something to check back on. Go out to the Horicon National Wildlife Refuge pages and see if they're going to have that camera going, because that would give you a chance to see firsthand. And it's pretty fun. It was really fun to watch the adults come flying in and land on the nest, and the chicks standing precariously on the edge of the nest as it's, you know, presumably 40 feet up in the air. So pretty interesting. So watch for that camera this spring, summer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jerry. Christy in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling, Christy.
Hi, Larry. Yesterday, skiing in the Blue Hills near Bruce, Wisconsin, there were a lot of turkey tracks, and then the rustling in the leaves on the forest floor. The snow cover is pretty shallow. I'm curious, there weren't any oak in that area, what the turkey are feeding on. And then also this morning in Irvine, again, the leaves rustled, but no turkey but deer tracks. And so the question there is, other than tracks, can you tell a difference between the two? And then I'm wondering if the guest would like to speak about the Breeding Bird Atlas project that's coming up. Thank you.
All right.
So, Christy, the question, as I understand it, are you asking about how to tell the difference in browsing?
Yes, between the browsing.
Yeah, okay. So, one of the things is to look at the browse relative to the ground level. And obviously turkeys can fly up into the trees and they can browse in the trees. But typically, you know, that browse, deer will reach upwards of maybe 7-8 feet if they stand on their rear feet or rear legs. And if they're on a snowpack, they can even be higher into the trees. So look at where that browse is relative to that. But the key indication is if you see a square or ragged break on that woody vegetation, that's clear deer browse. And the reason that square or ragged break occurs is because deer have lost their upper two front teeth, or those upper incisors, and they've never replaced them through evolution. And so when deer grab something to eat, they pinch it between the lower incisors and that gum line in the upper jaw, and they pull at it. And that's what gives that square or ragged break. And turkeys typically will not eat woody vegetation, for one thing. They're primarily a forb and grass thing like that. So that's what you would look for, is height relative to the ground, but specifically look for that square or ragged break. And if you go to a search engine on the internet and just type in, you know, white-tailed deer browse, you'll see what I'm talking about in terms of that type of breakage on the woody vegetation. And then the other thing you asked about is the Breeding Bird Atlas. That is getting kicked off now. They are just starting to get all the logistics and the organization set up. And I bet you I'm getting 10 emails a day on that. But they're going to have a kickoff meeting here pretty soon. I don't recall exactly when, but if you go...
So this is an update of the Breeding Bird.
It is. It's an update of the Breeding Bird Atlas. And they're trying to get the routes, again, organized and all the people organized and things like that. It's a 5-year effort or so, large citizen science project. So they'll be putting out a call for citizen science birders to come help as well. And if you want to go either to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology or the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, or just Google Breeding Bird Atlas Wisconsin, I'm sure you'll find the information that talks about when it's going to, the exact dates and things like that. But the effort is getting underway right now, and it will start, I think, this breeding bird season.
All right. Christy, thanks again. Appreciate it. Let's give Leslie in Chippewa Falls a chance to join us. Leslie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for another great show. My husband hunts in the Cable, Wisconsin area, and they have not seen any deer, but tons of wolves. Wolf sign within 20 feet of the cabin where we stay. And I heard that the federal government or a judge put the wolves back on the endangered species list, and I don't have anything against wolves. I'm just looking for balance so that the men can continue gun deer hunting. A lot of them are talking about not buying licenses next year because they haven't seen any deer for a number of years.
All right.
Well, thanks for the question, the comment, and relaying some of your husband's accounts from this past deer hunting season. And it's not uncommon for us to hear those reports coming back from the field. So you're correct in that wolves were recently relisted at the decision of a federal judge. And as far as impact of wolves on the deer population, just to put some numbers for you to think about, if we say the wolf population is around 1,000 animals, and it's believed that wolves, a single wolf, will eat between 17 and 18 deer in a given year, you're looking at about 18,000 deer being consumed by wolves in a year, compared to 350,000 deer harvested during the 9-day gun deer season, 30 to 40,000 hit by cars on the road. So in terms of wolves impacting the deer population, they are not going to have that widespread population impact. However, in local areas where you have wolves, they could change deer behavior. I would also make the argument that habitat may have changed where your husband is hunting, and where we get changes over the past few years from other hunting groups. It has, again, to do with maturing of the forest and a lack of deer habitat or quality habitat for deer, more so than it does of having wolves in the area as a potential predator.
I don't think they'll, as you say, I don't think they're going to eat up all the deer in the area.
No.
But, you know.
They can change the behavior of how those local animals move around and
if you get a pack of wolves in an area, the deer are not, the smart ones are not going to stay there, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't think.
Right. There was also a recent research study, too, though, that was looking at radio collared deer and wolves in the same area, and they were within pretty close proximity and kind of getting along just fine, but again, under suitable habitat for each as well.
Very interesting. Thanks a lot, Leslie, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have lots of photos, by the way, on our Facebook page, so I hope you have a chance to go to the post to the page. We've got bobcats, we got eagles, we got hawks, we got deer, we got turkeys, a little bit of everything. And it's always a lot of fun to look at those. We had Jerry emailed us, and this was a clarification on the bird standing on ice. Jerry says, standing on ice, they don't close off circulation. They use a counter current vein against the artery to keep from cooling the core.
Yeah, so Jerry is partially correct. So they do have the vein artery system right next to each other. So as the cool blood is coming back to the body, that warm blood that's leaving the body helps to warm the cool blood coming up. And so that is true. But they also have the ability, they have a shunt on that blood vessel, so they can actually stop the blood from going deep down into the leg, and the leg obviously is not feathered. So on cold days, when you have just skin there and the blood's going right under the skin, you lose a lot of heat, and it causes that animal to spend energy to heat that blood back up as it comes into the body. So they do have the ability also to shunt off the blood so it doesn't go all the way down into the leg before it comes back up to the body.
Talking about the world of wildlife and having a lot of fun with David Drake and Jamie Knack. You stay with us. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store, and then we'll be right back. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the amazing world of our Wisconsin wildlife today with two great guests, David Drake, wildlife specialist and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology with UW-Madison and UW-Extension. David, great to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jamie Knack, wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Always a pleasure, Jamie.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Great to have you along. We have lots of great photos and comments on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that, and I hope you will because there's some wonderful photos. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or phone at 1-800-642-1234. And I did want to go to Facebook for a minute because Mary had sent several pictures from last summer. She said, I was mowing grass, it was this fall actually, on our farm, and this hawk followed me all over. He was enjoying the leopard frogs that were being chopped by the mower. I couldn't be helped. I was able to get very close. He was not frightened. It was an amazing day, and here he is, red tail, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, it's hard to, he's kind of a weird angle on some of these pictures, but yeah, it does look like a red tail hawk.
Perched on their car, perched in and then a very close up, close up shot, a couple of them in on the lawn.
You know, you see this a lot of times in the, when farmers are haying, that you'll see a lot of raptors and turkey vultures kind of working that mow line because all the animals that are hiding in the grass are running out in front of the mower. Or when you have prescribed burns, a lot of times you see these animals that are working, the raptors and turkey vultures are working the fire line because all these animals are running in front of the line. And it's kind of a, herding their prey for them. It's helping them hunt. So it's a pretty neat thing to see when you do see it.
Interesting Facebook question from Brody, wondering if anybody studied the impact of turkeys on snakes in the state. At my farm near Scandinavia, as the turkey population has increased, it seems like my fox snake population has dramatically declined. Or it could be increased predation by coyotes or some other predator?
Turkeys will eat snakes, but a fox snake's a pretty sizable snake. I mean, they can get upwards of 5 feet long, and that's too big a snake for a turkey to eat. But they will eat young snakes, so snakes just hatching out or just born. We have the brown's decay snake is a real tiny, 8-inch snake in the state. They'll eat something like that. But what I'm guessing might be going on, Brody, is if you've got an increasing turkey population there, you probably have really good turkey habitat, which means that they've got a lot of open forested areas, so not a lot of undergrowth in the forest. And as you get rid of that undergrowth, you're also removing the habitat that those snakes use for cover. And so the snakes either may be moving out of the area, or they're also more easily predated by raptors and raccoons and things like that. The other option is possibly there was a hibernaculum nearby that got upset or is no longer usable, and the snakes had to move out of the area. So there's a bunch of plausible reasons, but turkeys predating on fox snakes probably is not the reason the fox snakes are no longer there.
Jane in Waukesha, thank you so much for waiting. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just had a question. Someone had called in about turkeys being ground nesters, and we have a lot of them around here, around our yard and the farm fields, and I see them about dusk go up in pine trees. So I guess I assumed that's where they were sleeping. I don't know.
Yeah, that is.
My other question. Oh, okay. The other question is, I've seen, or I've noticed, I haven't seen them, the pheasants. And when I was a child, I used to see all kinds of pheasants all around, and I'm wondering if the turkeys have displaced them.
Oh, all right. Couple of interesting questions.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Lots of turkey questions today. Turkeys do nest on the ground in long grasses for concealment. Obviously, that's the hen that's tending to the nest, but they roost in trees. So they sleep at night. They're spending time up on the trees or in the trees, and whether that's a large pine tree or an oak tree with sprawling branches, they roost there overnight to avoid predators. So the hen that is incubating the eggs, she's going to stay on that nest throughout the night during the breeding or during the nesting season. So tall grasses where she can help kind of camouflage and conceal herself from predators. So sometimes it could be in grassy linear strips in fields. When I was doing some grassland bird work in pastures, we had turkeys nesting in some of the taller grasses of pastures and kind of old waterways that were dried up at the time. So, yeah, so they nest on the ground but roost in the trees.
Okay.
And then her other question was
about the pheasants.
Yeah, about the pheasants. So, again, we often blame species when we see one species take off, like turkey populations moving on the increase, and maybe in the Southwest grouse populations decreasing, or fewer pheasants in the state. Not the case. It is most likely a combination of habitat loss in terms of grasslands. We used to have many more CRP, Conservation Reserve Program fields, or set aside fields with grasses for pheasants, and we don't have as much habitat for them. That coupled with fragmentation and predation, we've seen a decrease in our more wild pheasants.
Yeah, ability for pheasants to live from one year to
correct.
The next. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Jane, for calling. Jerry in Chippewa Falls. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello there. I got two questions for you. First, I heard that the wild boar population is coming into southern Wisconsin. I was just wondering if you could touch on that. The other one is I'm a valid hunter and outdoorsman, and I've been in hunting in the northwest, in the northern state for a long time, and I've seen a high demand from selling corn at all the gas stations for the hunters, and they're putting out so much corn that you're not seeing the routine of a normal deer during the day anymore. And I was just wondering if there was a study on that shows that by overfeeding the deer, they don't have to do their normal routine as they normally walk through the day to feed. And it seems like they're always nocturnal now.
All right, first question on the feral hogs. So we have had feral hogs in the state. There is an effort to eradicate them because of the environmental damage they cause, because they root the vegetation. So they eat, they basically dig up the plants and the forbs, leaving the habitat destroyed. So they're a huge problem in the southern part of the country, and we really don't want them to establish themselves here. So there's an eradication effort there. And in fact, as you're hunting or come across them, you can shoot them.
At any time of the year.
At any time of the year. And as far as I know, they are pretty limited now to Crawford County. In that particular area of the state. So kind of controlled, and when they do have sightings, they get on that pretty quickly and work with landowners and others in the area to try to get those animals. Wildlife Services was involved, too, in trying to trap those animals. Your second question, as far as feeding, we should make the distinction between baiting and feeding. So feeding of animals, including deer. You meant baiting?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So during the hunting season, as far as the baiting goes, and I should make everybody aware that because of chronic wasting disease in our deer herd in parts of the state, baiting and feeding is banned in, it was 26, I think it's still around 26 counties. So there are some counties in the state where you cannot bait or feed because of the disease concerns. So
I understand that, but I've seen so many larger piles in there that are in the Shawangunk Forest, National Forest, that aren't actually legal that they've been putting out.
Then, Jerry, there's only one thing that you should do. Then you should follow up on the tip line with the Wisconsin DNR.
Why don't they just ban it completely?
Because it's
hot. Why is it still here?
Because it is very hotly debated. So when you look at the hunting community, and it has been attempted. So one, it has to be a change that comes out of statute with the legislature. The DNR cannot just make that change. It has to come through state statute. And the public has been fairly divided on the topic. I want to say more recently it's been closer to 60-40 in support of the ban on baiting and feeding when we ask the hunting community. So there are many who feel the same way you do. There are also those from the economics, as you mentioned, selling corn and all the bags of corn that you see, and some stakeholders on that end of it too. So it has been attempted, but again, it's not the DNR's. Doesn't have control over that. It's the legislature.
There we go. And appreciate your call very much. Thank you so much for calling. And it is really discouraging. You're hunting in an area, and then you know, just a ways over, somebody's put in a huge mound of corn illegally.
Yep.
It is, and if you don't necessarily care to do that, you have to make a choice, you know, because it is pulling deer.
Right. Plus, if you're concerned for the welfare or the health of the deer, you don't want to put corn out anyway. That's not the best bait pile for it. If you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, we've talked about this before, but they've got excellent guidelines on what, if you do want to establish a bait pile legally and you're legal to do it where you live, they've got great guidelines on what kind of bait to use and what to avoid and things like that. So go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and what do you think? Just search item deer bait or something like that.
But bottom line, there are restrictions on the quantity that can be placed for hunting. So if you come across in a public forest like that and there's large quantities, you should report it.
Absolutely. Yep,
there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Kewaunee up next. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm up in Green Bay now, but we were on vacation last week, and we were in Forest County doing some hiking in the woods, and came across a small spring, a creek, and we noticed there were some fairly large canine tracks going down, you know, the middle of the river. We know there are wolf sightings in that area where we were staying, and kind of the general consensus is up there among people is that, you know, we're really not safe walking in the woods anymore, that we should be carrying some sort of protection. Is that a valid concern, or is that just, we just don't understand the wolf and how it can, what it can do to us out there?
Well, Jim, I think it comes down to kind of personal preferences and what you need to feel comfortable. And certainly we have to be careful about the firearm laws and regulations for what you can and can't do at that given time of year and how you carry and those things. So given that, I think it's what gives you peace of mind. So in northern Wisconsin, we certainly have had wolves attack hunting dogs, whether they be hunting snowshoe hare or running coyotes or bears. So wolves, when you get into their territories, their rendezvous sites, we have had incidences where they've competed with domestic dogs. So they're within the canid family. They don't tolerate each other very well, especially during those specific times of the year. So if I were to go hunting in the northern part of the state and taking my dogs, I would run them with bells, and I would look at the DNR's website where there are maps of where the wolf pack territories are, and then the packs that have had previous depredation histories, whether that be on pets or on livestock, those are indicated. So you can help yourself a little bit by looking at where those caution areas are and making sure that you're, again, being safe when you're in those areas. And then if you're traveling with a dog and you're just out there hiking, keep the dog close to you. So I think there's more concern for probably the dogs when you're walking through some of these territories and the time of year. Otherwise, in general, I would say just making yourself large, not running away, making yourself, being vocal and standing your ground and walking out of the situation. So, again, the DNR website is a good source, too, to look at those pack distributions in the state and help make that decision.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that there was actually that type of information. And we wouldn't take our dog out in the woods anyway. We don't do that type of hunting or hiking, for that matter,
right. Because
we've run too many porkies in the past. So.
Yeah, been there, too.
All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have... let's see, Rich in Wauwatosa up next. Hi, Rich.
Hey, good afternoon. Excellent program as always.
Thank you.
A few years ago, I was in a Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, and I had a cougar run in front of my vehicle. And I contacted the park officials the following day, and boy, they didn't bat an eyelash. And you know, since then, there's been several actual visual or trail camera sightings of cougars in Juneau County. And any comments as to maybe why they didn't put a little more emphasis on my sighting?
Well, I can't speak for that particular person that you contacted. You may have tried another just to see if you got a different response. But what I can say is in more recent years, certainly we've confirmed that cougars have moved through the state. So, that's been documented both by trail cameras, by finding tracks and having them confirmed through blood or hair and then DNA analysis. And all of the cougars that have been documented moving through the state have all been tracked back to the Black Hills population in South Dakota. So that's the population they're coming from. They've also been males, young males, that are dispersing from that traditional population in South Dakota. And we do not have any, we haven't documented any females or any breeding activity to this point. So they're kind of a, you know, an animal that's moving through the area. But more recently, I would say when and if somebody has a sighting like that, contact the natural resource or the DNR wildlife biologist for that area, because they will hopefully either come out if there is evidence, whether that's tracks or scats or anything like that that they can collect, but also they can fill out the information and keep it in the database. So it may have been just that a couple years ago it wasn't maybe necessarily on the radar. We didn't have as much evidence as we have in more recent years to kind of track these animals and know that they have been confirmed through the state. So
there you go.
I don't know exactly why that person, but, you know, again, the please do report those sightings.
And thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. Facebook question from Marie. I've always been curious why radio collars are used for tracking animals. Isn't that a risk for getting, you know, the things getting caught on tree limbs or whatever? Why not microchips?
Well, there have been a lot of studies out there, and Anne Marie, this is a very good question. So there have been a lot of studies out there that have looked at the impact to attaching something like a radio collar to an animal. And radios, not necessarily radio collars, but radio tracking devices are attached to small birds. They're attached to things as large as whales, you know, polar bears, the whole spectrum of animals. And the studies have been done to look at the impact of attaching something like a radio to an animal, that the animal that has the radio compared to a cohort that doesn't have the radio, there does not appear to be any higher mortality rate. There doesn't appear to be any ill effect to the animals that have the radio. And typically when you have the radio on the animal, you do work that radio, be it a collar or a backpack radio for snowy owl, for example. You do work that into either the coat or the feathers so that it's not readily apparent. If the collar has a kind of a tab to it, that's you'd cut that tab off so that there's nothing, no extra appendages on that collar that kind of hang the animal up. And so we were really careful about it because obviously if we go to all the trouble and effort to trap these animals or catch them in some capacity and then radio collar them, we want them to live as long as possible so we can gather as much data as possible. So we don't want to do anything with these radios that would jeopardize the animal's life in any way. And the some of those microchips and things like that, sometimes they don't give you the data that you're looking for depending on the specific objective of the study. There's some other issues with them. They don't transmit as far as maybe a VHF or a satellite radio would and things of that nature. So there's some restraints based on the technology relative to the kind of the type of data you're trying to get and the questions you're trying to answer.
John in Chippewa Falls has a question. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a question regarding how we manage deer in Wisconsin might be affecting the biodiversity of, say, our forests. I've hunted in Bernay Island State Park before, and I saw plenty of large hemlock trees, but no little ones.
Yeah.
Comment about that.
Well, certainly managing Wisconsin's deer population is, again, there are many stakeholders involved.
And forests.
And forests, and of differing opinions on what that herd should be and how many deer per square mile of habitat and so on. So certainly there are numerous research studies that have showed that deer can impact the forest understory. And if you want to confirm that, encourage them to build a deer enclosure on that property.
It's amazing.
And in a matter of a couple of years, you'll see the difference between inside that enclosure to the outside in terms of both the forbs and shrubs and the saplings that you're speaking of. So they certainly do impact forest regeneration when they're at higher populations.
And that's absolutely true. And what, you know, another external pressure on especially hemlock forests is a little insect called the woolly adelgid, which also has impacted negatively the hemlock forest in the eastern half of the United States and impacted it drastically. So it may be deer, but it also, you know, these forests are under disease pressure, insect pressure, pressure from urbanization and everything else.
I've seen enclosures on farm fields, too.
Yep.
Yeah,
the
it's
difference
pretty
in
amazing.
A hay field is absolutely amazing, and the height of the hay inside and outside the enclosure.
It's dramatic.
Dramatic. Pat wonders from Cadott if mourning doves migrate.
They can, and as a matter of fact, if you hunt mourning doves, you need a migratory bird stamp to do so. So they are considered a migratory bird, although it's common, at least in the southern part of the state of Wisconsin, to see them here year-round. But yes, they can migrate.
Wow, we have covered a whole lot of things today, including we got a lot of turkey questions today, which is fun always and interesting.
Diversity is good.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and we had somebody who saw... Oh, gosh, what was it? A red-winged blackbird.
Oh, yes, in southeast Minnesota. And they were wondering about, was it a late migrant or what the case is? And so, again, as Jamie has mentioned and we've mentioned today, we've had a relatively mild winter, and red-winged blackbirds are a early returning migratory bird. So it's possible that the animal just got an early jump on returning to a breeding ground and found your yard.
We will, you guys are coming back, I hope. Yeah, yes, you are.
Yep, as long as you invite us.
Well, you're invited back. Jamie Nack and David Drake from the University of Wisconsin Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and the University of Wisconsin Extension. They'll be back. We'll do it again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at researching your family's history and then another book on Viennese recipes. Stay with us.